This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The global pandemic has shown how governments and all of us can change at scale and speed. Now is the time to clean up our act on climate change, to roll up our sleeves and get our hands dirty while restarting our battered economies.
That's Harriet Lamb, Chief Executive Officer of Ashden, a UK-based charity that supports sustainable energy solutions. Details coming up also. Unidentified gunmen killed 32 civilians in Mali's Mopti region. And a popular protest singer's death in Ethiopia has heightened ethnic tensions as the protest spread in the country's Oromia region. All these and more ahead on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. The French Appeals Court confirmed today the dismissal of indictments of 9 Rwandans, all close to President Paul Kagame, in the investigation into the attack on the plane of President Habyarimana, which was considered to be trigger for the country's 1994 genocide. The action is considered an important judicial step in the procedure that has gone on for more than 20 years. Nicolas Pinot has more from Paris.
After 6 months of deliberations, the judges of the investigating chamber of the appeals court confirmed the decision of anti-terrorist judges taken in 2018. They had ordered that the prosecution be dropped for 9 members or former members of Kagame's entourage. The court has not explained the reasons for its decision. The defense says it is relieved, even if the action does not definitely close the file. The civil parties have already announced a cassation appeal. The assassination of Habyarimana in 1994 is recognized as setting off the genocide in Rwanda that left 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus dead. The investigation into the incident has poisoned diplomatic relations between Paris and Kigali for decades. In a first reaction after today's announcement, Rwanda Justice Minister said on Twitter that the case was a travesty of justice, a masquerade which should have never seen the light of the day. Nicolas Pinault, VOA News, Paris.
At least 80 people have died in protests this week in Ethiopia following the killing of popular singer Hachalu Hundessa. Known for his political songs, Hundessa's death has heightened ethnic tensions in Ethiopia as the protests spread to the Oromia region where Hundessa was born. As authorities shut down the internet in parts of the country, analysts say officials need to manage the country's political system well to avoid unrest. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
Security remains tight across Ethiopia day after the funeral of revered singer and musician Hachalu Hundessa. His killing this week sparked riots in and around Addis Ababa, leaving at least 80 dead. Muridi Mutiga is a Horn of Africa project director at the International Crisis Group. He says the anger witnessed in the streets of Ethiopia was not only about the killing of the musician, but also the country's underlying historical grievances by different ethnic groups.
This whole transition is characterized by very substantial, complex tensions, and the killing of the young musician was essentially a trigger because of the deep frustration that some of the protesters still feel. This killing served as a spark and a trigger for substantial unrest as we have witnessed.
Hundessa was gunned down Monday night in Addis Ababa, a week after he appeared on the Oromo Media Network, where he criticized Ethiopia's leadership and spoke against the mass incarceration of Oromo youth. The musician was ethnic Oromo, a group that has a long history of being discriminated against. Since Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed came to power in 2018, ethnic groups demand for political, social and economic inclusion, and in some cases, independence have been growing. When he came to power, Abiy promised his administration will take a different approach to the country's problems. Fiseha Tekle, an Ethiopia researcher for rights group Amnesty International, says security forces continue to use force in dealing with demonstrators.
Our preliminary findings indicate that the security forces were shooting at protesters just because they burned tires or they demolished houses or government buildings. That's the case in Adama, for instance. Well, there are some instances where there were ethnic clashes. We can see that the behavior of the security forces towards protests is not in line with human rights standards because they usually use lethal force against protesters.
Jawar Mohammed, opposition politician Bekele Garba, and 33 others were detained by police in connection with riots over the past week. Abiy has vowed to restore calm in the country. Police say three people have been arrested in connection with Wundesa's killing. They gave no details, but the Prime Minister said the shooting could be tied to the assassination of the chief of the Ethiopian army last year. Mutega says the country needs to carry on with its reforms.
Ethiopia's transition is very carefully watched. It has been a source of hope for many in Ethiopia and outside the country. It's essential that elites really don't fritter away all that hope. They need to find a way to talk. They need a way to find a way to resolve their differences and bring the transition back on track.
Meanwhile, to limit the spread of the violence, authorities have cut internet and mobile phone service. Officials have also postponed elections that were scheduled for next month until next year. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
Unidentified armed men on motorcycles and other vehicles attacked four villages in Mali's Mopti region yesterday, killing at least 32 civilians. Officials in the area told Reuters they believe the attacks were carried out by jihadists who often say they are defending Fulani herders against Dogon farmers. No group so far has claimed responsibility for the massacre. Mali's army could not be reached immediately for comment. The army has been criticized by rights groups and residents for failing to protect civilians in central Mali. Mali has been in crisis since 2012, when Al-Qaeda-linked militants seized its desert north. French forces intervened the following year to drive them back, but militants linked to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State have since regrouped and expanded their operations into neighboring Burkina Faso and Niger. The annual Ashton Awards have honored five projects in Africa offering climate solutions. The awards are a globally recognized measure of excellence in the field of sustainable energy, given to low-carbon pioneers around the world which are creating resilience, green growth, and fairer societies. From the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, VOA's Ruben Chama reports.
Ashton Awards winners receive tailored support to help them scale up their work and a prize of up to 20,000 British pounds, or an equivalent of $25,000. Harriet Lamp is chief executive of Ashden, a UK-based charity that supports sustainable energy solutions. She addressed the virtual celebration of the awards this week.
The global pandemic has shown how governments and all of us can change at scale and speed. Now is the time to clean up our act on climate change, to roll up our sleeves and get our hands dirty while restarting our battered economies. And these Ashton pioneers give us the building blocks, brick by brick, to a just recovery and a just transition.
The Togolese Rural Electrification and Renewable Energy Agency won the award for System Innovation for Energy Access. The public-private partnership plans to electrify 300,000 rural homes by 2022 and deliver total electrification of the West African country by 2030. Its ambitious on- and off-grid plan included solar home systems and mini-grids for the rural poor. New Energy Nexus Uganda, the run-up in the award category, provides financing and mobile technology to around 100 small-scale community enterprises that allow them to sell clean energy products such as solar systems, improved cookstoves, and non-electric water filters. Nearly 100,000 people living in mainly rural areas now have access to clean energy products, and the program is looking to scale up within Uganda and in other African countries. Marvin Tumusime is a program manager at New Energy Nexus Uganda.
The Ashden Awards are influential in recognizing the work of many organizations around the world that are working hard to preserve the environment through innovation. We share this honor with entrepreneurs we are currently supporting and those that will be joining us to do this great work.
LAMP says the pioneering organizations are lowering emissions while improving communities' livelihoods and health and reducing inequality.
As we set off this climate decade, we must imagine and create new ways of running our societies and economies. That takes imaginative and creative people who are fashioning cutting-edge solutions.
But Tumusime says some challenges abound.
Our biggest challenge so far has been competition from counterfeit products on the market, which are very cheap compared to those sold by our entrepreneurs. Many of our last mile customers have not acquired enough knowledge to differentiate the original products from counterfeits.
Other finalists include eConsult, a female-led architecture company in Egypt, recognized for its pioneering green building techniques, using recycled materials, integrating natural and passive cooling designs and solar technology, and making building flash flood-proof. During the COVID-19 pandemic, they have repurposed their businesses to build fast assembly, modular, solar and mobile clinics. In Cameroon, a natural climate solution by Cameroon Gender and Environment Watch, the run-up in the Natural Climate Solutions Award category, showed potential for replication after bee farming reforestation techniques dramatically reduced bushfires. Forest communities in the Kilum-Lijim region, frequently hit by forest fires, are being supported to become honey farmers instead of resorting to slash and burn agriculture. British-based ethical investment company Energize Africa, which crowdsources funds to invest in solar businesses in sub-Saharan Africa, was recognized as runner-up in the Financial Innovation for Energy Access Award. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
The Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam continues to be a major source of disagreement among the Nile River countries of Ethiopia, Sudan, and Egypt. VOA Salem Salomon spoke to U.S. Congresswoman Karen Bass of California about a letter the Congressional Black Caucus issued in regards to the GERD and what the U.S. appropriate role is in mediating the tensions.
The Congressional Black Caucus, of which you chair, sent a letter that highlighted the importance of the dam in providing electricity to the region. However, Egypt has been critical of the dam, warning that it could reduce its access to fresh water and make agricultural use unusable for the people around there. So do you think there's a resolution to this conflict that will satisfy all three countries?
Well, you know, that's difficult for me to say if there's a resolution. You know, the point of our letter and my perspective is that I think it's important to let the three countries resolve it themselves. I was worried when the U.S. became involved, and I thought that that could just complicate things, considering that we have very different relationships with each country.
That's right. And speaking of the U.S., U.S.'s involvement, the U.S. Department of Treasury has been playing a mediation role between the three countries. Do you think the U.S. has played a constructive role and hasn't been impartial so far?
Well, I mean, I think it depends on the country's perspective you're looking at. I think from the Ethiopian perspective, they were very concerned. You know, but there's a more fundamental problem here. And the fundamental problem is the Trump administration and the Trump administration's real lack of a strategy and a perspective on the African continent. And so that then, there's not a level of trust and relationship there. And so I don't think it's a good situation to begin with when it comes to the Trump administration trying to broker anything in Africa.
Egypt has also been referencing a colonial era. They've cited that colonial era law many times. This time is an awakening all across the world of revisiting of colonial remnants.
Yes.
And so any thoughts on that?
Yes, I mean, I think that the world is going through the same thing. And then I'm proud to say, you know, probably emanated through the protests here in the United States. You know, the death, the torturous, slow murder of George Floyd certainly raised the issue of human rights in the United States. I was very grateful and proud that all 54 African countries went to the United Nations and raised this issue. I thought that was good. And it's caused countries, it's caused people in Europe to look at their roots for slavery and colonialism. And so I think that that's a good thing. I mean, in the United States, we're still fighting the Civil War. And the idea that we actually had statues and other things that enshrine people who tried to destroy the country, it makes no sense. And they were dedicated white supremacists. So we've had this soul searching time in the United States, and I think that other countries are mirroring that. And so looking at colonial laws, I know some countries are looking at even the names of streets and buildings. And I think that's right. I think that's part of evolution and part of moving forward.
That was U.S. Congresswoman Karen Bass speaking to VOA Salem Solomon. Uganda has allowed in 260 Congolese refugees who have been stranded in a forest since Kampala closed the border over COVID-19. The refugees are currently under quarantine at a Ugandan institution as precautionary measures against spread of COVID-19. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
The closure of borders with Uganda's neighbors in an effort to stop the spread of the coronavirus left thousands of refugees and asylum seekers stranded in forests at the border of the Democratic Republic of Congo. The United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, says most of those stranded are women, children, and the elderly who are fleeing escalating violence in the eastern DRC. They have been stranded in a remote area since late May. It is only this week that Uganda temporarily reopened its borders to allow in a fraction of the refugees who will be resettled in Zombo district. Ingnia Hilary Onek is Uganda's Minister for Refugees and Disaster Preparedness.
Courtesy to our government and our president, I welcome to Uganda. Those who have been come to the boundaries, we are not tired. We don't have much land. Our country is small, but we still allow them out of sympathy.
The refugees are to be subjected to a vigorous screening exercise and 14 days mandatory institutional quarantine before they are relocated to the settlement. Philippe Krippi is the UNHCR assistant representative for operations in Uganda.
You are putting, of course, accommodation, screening for COVID. As you know, it is a very special emergency. It's the first time people are crossing in the middle of the COVID situation. You need to place mask to put all in place, screening for security, screening for COVID and Ebola. As you know, there are also some cases of Ebola in DRC. The team are doing our best to be ready.
This, however, comes at a time Uganda is grappling with dwindling funds for refugee relief programs, as most resources have been shifted to fight COVID-19. Joe Boutreau is the UNHCR Uganda representative. He is afraid the new entries will put pressure on the already overstretched refugee response plan.
All that has been going on around, you know, trying to get these quarantine centers center open and the others around the country. And it is costing a lot of money, too. It means that we're taking money from elsewhere, from other key sectors like education, like health. So the little money we had to play with in terms of trying to extend education and health, for example, has now disappeared because of the need to face COVID.
Minister Hilary Onek has called on the international community to help Uganda host the refugees.
I wish the international community also becomes sympathetic and help these people. These are not our problems. These are the world's problems, international problems.
Due to COVID-19, the food ration for refugees has been cut by 30%, and the country also faces funding shortfalls for programs like education, child protection, and health services for the refugees. Uganda is home to over 1.4 million refugees, most of them from South Sudan and DRC. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Life in Zimbabwe continues to be increasingly difficult with runaway inflation causing constant price hikes and the buying power of the local currency eroding dramatically. Many blame the government and a pressure group is threatening to take action to hold it accountable. Reporter Kuzai Zanawashi has the details.
Protests have been part of Zimbabwe's recent history. Despite brutal, sometimes deadly crackdowns that can cause would-be protesters to pose, in the last days of strongman Robert Mugabe's rule, protests by local civic pressure group Tajamuka were rife, including a national shutdown. Livelihoods have not improved since then, and Tajamuka is threatening to hit the streets again despite what they call government intimidation tactics. Promise Mukwananzi is with the group.
Tajamuka says Jigile, the People's Revolutionary Movement, deeply concerned by the gloom and despair born out of the abject poverty, hunger and suffering of our people, which has reached desperate levels.
Mkwananzi says what makes matters worse is that much of the suffering is man-made, and he blames those with a mandate to rule, including President Mnangagwa. He says going forward, as a movement, they will be taking action.
It is our strong-held view that we must now come together in our collective wisdom and strength as citizens to bring the madness to an end. Mnangagwa and his government have failed and must leave. The movement believes that the solution to the current standoff is a decisive, resilient, sustained season of peaceful, non-violent, and action-oriented national protests.
Government officials have not taken a clear stand on the possibility of protests. Tendai Chirau is the Deputy National Secretary in the ruling ZANU-PF's youth wing.
The Tajamuka project is a project meant to enrich some people, and these are demopreneurs. They make money through engaging in causing anarchy and despondency. What we encourage the people of Zimbabwe is not to follow and not to be hoodwinked by people who want to make money through demonstrations.
He adds that Tajamuka is bent on causing chaos, but without solutions to the problems the nation is facing. Mkwananzi says they are encouraged by pockets of protests across the country, with teachers and nurses frequently demonstrating for better pay and conditions. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashi from Harare.
As part of measures to curb the spread of COVID-19, a Ugandan innovator has come up with a plastic shield for motorcycles to protect both driver and passenger. The shield is seen as not just reducing body contact, which could spread the virus, but also adding security for motorcycle taxi drivers. Halima Tumani reports from Kampala.
Uganda has hundreds of thousands of motorcycles on its roads, and most of them work as taxis known as border borders. But since April, the COVID-19 pandemic, the government has banned motorcycle taxis because of the close proximity between the driver and passengers. To solve that problem, Dixon Jirani created a plastic shield to mount between them.
We believe the shield is entirely going to protect the passenger from getting contaminations on the road in the process of moving. Number two, he will not get direct contact with the rider.
4 months into Uganda's lockdown, border drivers currently allowed only to deliver goods are struggling to make a living. Drivers such as Fred Luaga are urging authorities to let them take passengers if they use the shield. He says, this shield, we all as border riders should use it because I see there's distance. He says, if I'm seated here and the passenger is at the back, I don't see how we are going to get infected by COVID-19. Uganda's Ministry of Works and Transport says it is investigating the effectiveness of the shield. The ministry's chief engineer, Tony Kavuma, says one concern is that passengers will wrongly believe the shield is all they need for protection.
That is the use of the masks and the helmet, a fully covered helmet. Because that one, it shields the rider. If in case he or she is infected, they'll be able to contain the droplets. That's number one. Two, it will, in case of a fall, it will also protect the head.
It's not clear when Ugandan authorities will allow passengers back onto border borders. Meanwhile, Njirani says they are manufacturing more shields in anticipation of high demand. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thanks again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.